Welcome to Discover Indie Film. I am Jeff Howard, and this is really fun for me. I've got filmmaker Chris Brown with me. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Jeff.
I didn't warn you that I was going to say hi early. I should have warned you. I like to say hi so the intro doesn't sound like a monologue, even though it's totally a monologue. But hey, Chris Brown is here, and I met Chris at Film Invasion Los Angeles 2023 because his film Pleroma was an official selection. And by the way, cursing is allowed. It's a fucking kick-ass movie. It's just such a good sci-fi short. In fact, it won Outstanding Short Film Sci-Fi, the Filmmakers Award. It also won the Filmmakers Award for Outstanding Screenplay Sci-Fi. And I think you know this, but the Filmmakers Awards are decided by a jury of filmmakers who were official selections in past years and very often award winners. So, like, that's an award from your peers, which I think means more. Like, people love the Grand Jury Awards, but, like, that's just, like, a bunch of people who've been around indie film too long and, like, involved in film festivals, whereas the filmmakers, like, those are your peers. So, anyway, you got awards from your peers for your excellent film. And now here we are. We're just going to talk about you and your career. The film can't be seen yet because you're still on the festival circuit. In fact, you want to say when your premiere is?
The Los Angeles premiere will be around October 10th at Screamfest. And beyond that, it's screening at film festivals throughout North America and Europe. But yeah, I'll be keeping updates on my website on where you can check it out in the film festivals. And then eventually it will reach online, probably late fall, early winter of this year.
And Screamfest, that's the horror festival?
Yeah, that's a horror sort
it's
of
like
genre.
It's really well regarded, right?
Yeah, yeah. It is known as the festival that broke the whole Paranormal Activity franchise. It's got a lot of clout. A lot of industry people that I know are very much aware of Screamfest, and it's sort of the pulse of what's coming up for either horror or thriller or sort of genre sci-fi type projects. So yeah, it's definitely a big film festival, and it screens on Hollywood Boulevard at the TCL Chinese Theater.
For sure, which is a great theater. Almost as good as Look Cinemas in Glendale, but it doesn't have leather recliners.
It doesn't have food that you can order to your seat.
Food you can order. I am now. That's definitely not a humble brag. That's just a straight out brag about the Film Invasion LA theater that we're finally in a fantastic theater.
But I would agree with that. It is an incredible theater, and it was an amazing experience screening there.
Absolutely. And we did, to honor the fact that Screamfest is going to do your LA premiere, we did honor it and just show your trailer. But I'm familiar with the whole film because I watched it like a couple times. In fact, my brother is an automotive engineer and a big nerd. And his son, my nephew, is a freshman at Georgia Tech who wants to work on satellites. So when they were here and they were like, show us a movie, I showed him Pleroma because why not? Like, they're sci-fi nerds.
Awesome. Did they like it?
They loved it.
Oh,
they
fantastic.
It. In fact, they loved it more than Solus. Not to knock Solus is amazing. But, you know, Solus is the one that took...
It was the NASA block, one, right?
Yeah, it's the one that took place on the space station.
That was great.
And of course, they were like, it's so good.
Yeah.
But these nerds, my brother doesn't listen to this, so I can say this. Like, the accuracy nerd in him was like, there's never one astronaut alone on the space station. They're always in pairs. And I'm like, dude, it's a story.
Mm-hmm.
Go with it. Yeah. But anyway. All right, so people should, they should fill that theater for Screamfest.
Ideally, yeah. That'd be fantastic.
I'm going to try to show up.
Please, please do.
And, now we can just talk about you. So you want to tell, by the way, I didn't bother saying that you work full time, right, as a digital artist.
Yep. I'm a visual effects supervisor at Sony Pictures Animation currently, so that's my day job. And independent filmmaker in my spare time.
Which is... I think I probably said it at the Q&A we did, but I'm like, you know, a lot of the people with really solid careers at the studios, they use their spare time to go to Europe and shit. They don't make indie films in their spare time. So special golf clap for Chris for staying devoted to the arts, even in your spare time.
Absolutely. Thank you.
And of course, it's why the film looks amazing. So you want to say, you want to just start, when did you first get into, did you get interested in film first and then VFX? Or were you always like really fascinated with VFX? Or what's your creative story? When did it start?
I would they happened simultaneously. I was super interested in filmmaking, even from as long as I could remember. I would probably say grade three. I remember my family had an old VHS Hi-8 camcorder that I would just play with all the time. And I would either shoot videos with friends and just try and enact our own creative ideas and movies. And also, I was really interested in animation, in particular claymation. So I'd have plasticine figures that I would use stop motion animation to make them move. Then eventually, as our computers became more advanced, I started playing with animation on computer and trying to marry that with the live action footage we were shooting. And it just kind of evolved into being sort of like anything I can get my hands on to depict some kind of very creative or interesting ideas that I might come up with by using whatever means possible. And often that was either visual effects or practical effects.
And you mentioned, you said the words grade three. You're from Canada, yeah?
Yes.
That's the Canada indication, grade three instead of third grade. Where'd you grow up in Canada?
Just a small town just north of Toronto. It's called Aurora, Ontario. So, yeah, it's a small town, not a lot to do, a lot of snow, very cold. So this was something I really enjoyed doing to sort of entertain myself and have fun with friends. But it just grew into this sort of obsession, really, just to keep creating content.
Right. And far enough from Toronto that whole Toronto television, like, because Toronto is like the home of TV production, right? And in Canada, like it's like where the CBC is based out of, right? So
yeah, exactly.
So, but you were far enough from that it wasn't like you grew up around production.
No, it was very far from all of that. I really didn't have any sort of connections or associates or even just geographically close to any kind of film production. It was all just very sort of grassroots, you know, coming up with what I can at the time.
Which is cool, right? Because the way you were playing with a Hi-8 camera and whatnot, that's the perfect, you know, I always think of it as you know, there's pre-law, there's also pre-film school, right? Because you're learning how editing works. You might have probably did some editing in camera and whatnot.
Oh, completely. I mean, this was pretty primitive equipment back then. So I would do very rough editing where I would string two VCRs together and I would hit pause and record and try and just, you know, do different editing and cuts while simultaneously playing a stereo in the background with music to try and put a soundtrack along with it. But yeah, it was very much a experimental ground for just seeing how footage worked together, how storytelling worked, and how mood and sending ambience would work in telling these sort of ideas that we had.
And not to skip to the end, but I can't help but notice that, like, You were a bit of a one person band, right? Making Pleroma, like you just dove in and did everything yourself. And it sounds like as a kid, you like dove in and just did everything yourself. You were like trying to problem solve everything, problem solve soundtrack, problem solve editing. You were just creating it from whole cloth. Is that the right way to say it? But
Like basically doing everything I could. I mean, I'd have a couple friends over, so there'd be three of us. So not only would we have to come up with stories that only involved two people on camera, but also just coming up with ideas to make these sci-fi stories. So I'd either build model spacecrafts and fly them on a fishing line, or I'd have firecrackers go off for explosions or creature puppets and that kind of thing. So pretty much like anything we can get our hands on to put in front of the camera, I would be working with. And that just grew into my fascination for trying to take on whatever my imagination could come up with. And of course, CGI and visual effects was definitely the tool to take that a whole step further. And that ended up being my entire career this far.
And did you discover that in high school or university?
Yeah, I would say in high school, I started dabbling with it. Definitely, it was very rudimentary at the time. But I definitely started. But when I went to business school, actually, university, and I got my Bachelor of Commerce degree. But while I was in school, I would get a little bit better film equipment, a little bit more into the CGI visual effects. Again, entirely self-taught. I would be recruiting friends from class to make more sophisticated movies now, and still just continuing with that sort of one-man band to try and make these projects. And then we even had screenings at the school. I mean, it was funny because it was not the furthest thing away from a arts program, but somehow I was able to pull people together and make these productions and have screenings. And it was a great time. Again, just an amazing time to explore and to experiment.
I can't help but observe. Well, first, a couple observations. First, how cool that you obviously had a practical mind to get a business degree instead of an arts degree. But while you're in a business program, I bet it's a lot easier to get business people interested in an arts thing than go to art school and say, hey, let's have a little seminar about the stock market. I'm not sure it would work the other way.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's a great way to look at it. But yeah, no, definitely easy to recruit people who are interested in being part of a film production, for sure.
Very cool. And did the business classes ever and the commerce stuff, did that help you in film in a way too?
Yeah, totally. It's really interesting because when I was in business school, like I said, I was making these projects in my spare time. So evening and lunches, and I always kind of fantasized like, you know, what would it be like if I can just do this all the time and not have to worry about taking finance or marketing? Although I was really interested in the marketing part. But then eventually after I got my commerce degree, I had built up this portfolio of these projects that I had worked on, and I took it to an animation school, and they said, look, based on the work that you have, you're so far along, you actually only need to go to our school for 6 months to earn your animation degree, whereas typically it'd be an 18-month program at least. So they said, come in, you go for 6 months, you know, brush up on your skills, learn from the professors we have here, and then you're good. So that's basically what I did. But to answer your question about the commerce degree, I did eventually start up my own business for visual effects. It was a small boutique shop. It had about 40 artists. We were in downtown Vancouver, Canada. We had an entire floor in a financial district. And we did a ton of business over 9 years. And so there I got to have my hands in both the business world as well as the animation, visual effects, and filmmaking.
I mean, I realize in the VFX world, a studio of 40 artists is, in air quotes, small. But that's a big business for an individual to run. I mean, most people don't have 40 people working under them and managing all that.
It was a huge undertaking. And it was very intimidating too. We had projects that were, you know, a million plus in budget, and we would have to find a way to pull these off. And it was extremely demanding. It was for broadcast television. And I was not only managing the business, the clients, but I was also building the visual effects pipeline, managing and critiquing the artist's work. So it was a humongous undertaking, and I was only 24 at the time, and it was a lot to take on. But yeah, we made it work, like I said, for 9 years, and it was an incredible experience, and I was able to grow as an artist, as a technical artist as well, and also someone who can work with clients and executives and plan projects and budget projects as well. So it's kind of all of the above.
Yeah, I mean, I know you as a humble person, and you handle compliments nicely, but I know you don't soak them up. But I mean, that's I almost want to use the word prodigy. Like you clearly, your passion for it plus your ability, like you had both. And so whether it was that graduate school of animation or setting up this business, like this combination, like you're kind of special. Like this, I'm coming out and calling you special because like a lot of people have the passion, but they don't have the competence you have the business mind, you have the art side handled. I mean, That's a very unique story, and it's got to make a lot of people fucking jealous.
thanks, I really appreciate it. I think, you know, it was just kind of like what I was doing. And I, you know, I didn't know everything going in, of course, how could you? But you figure it out. So you put yourself in these situations and you just rely on the fact that in hard work, lots of research, you can find a way to make these things happen. So.
Sure, sure. Should I ask if there was any like particularly fun or important projects that your shop did?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, we had a blast with this company. I had a business partner. But yeah, particular projects that stood out to me was there was we worked on this this television commercial, and it was more of like a sort of a marketing campaign. And the advertising company just loved the work that we were doing so much that they had come back to us to come up with campaigns for their commercials. So this was an opportunity for myself to kind of get back into that short filmmaking. These were television commercials, but they were super fun. I got to direct it. I got to come up with the ideas, art directed as well as visual effects supervised them. They were live action productions. So it was just so great to be on a set with proper funding and, you know, a big studio with green screen and just crank out these little projects that that I was really proud of. And it was an incredible learning experience as well. So those were particularly special for me. We had other productions where I did get to direct a full animated series as well, which was super cool. Very, like a ton of work. Long hours, but again, like I just loved what I was doing. I just constantly had this fuel to just keep going because I was really doing what I loved, to be honest.
For sure. And I guess the other question I should be asking is, were you writing up what your creative side of creating things for yourself from scratch as well, or just creating things? Were you always doing that in the background too with your spare time, or was like running the business just way too much? Or
I think like my sort of a creative writing and that sort of thing, I was sort of doing pitch decks for studios as well. So we'd work with companies and then pitch them our ideas. A big part of that was the commercial work we did as well. But after a while, I did decide like, look, instead of doing the client-based thing, I really wanted to add something additional to that. And that's where I went full-blown into script writing, a short film, entirely my own concept. Again, like you were mentioning, Jeff, the shooting, the directing, the visual effects, the editing, you know, doing it all myself. And those would hit the film festival market as well. And as well, use those as properties to try and sell as bigger productions, whether it be a feature or series or etc.
Right. And I assume, well, you didn't even need a calling card at that point, did you? Because I'm sure your VFX shop had more than enough work to show potential clients.
Definitely from a visual effects standpoint, but I think as a director or writer, especially a one that could come up with more than just commercials, I definitely think a calling card was something that would be good to have. And honestly, I mean, I had several reasons for making these productions. One, to have a calling card for my own vision, not one that's coming from a company. So my writing and design and look development aesthetic, as well as it was a great opportunity, again, for me to be involved hands-on with all aspects of a production and also use this, again, to sell it as a bigger production. So it's so much work that goes into these that having these three very important things to me to get out of it made it all worthwhile, I mean. But I will say, like, in animation school, I did create a short film that was about, it took place in the Victorian era. So think like Jack the Ripper type vibes, but it was about these mutant creatures that abducted people. And that was my first sort of quote unquote, very serious professional attempt at making a film, and outside of just having fun with friends. And that really started getting a lot of interest at the school. Like, faculty was asking me for copies of it so they can show around. And then I decided to start submitting it into film festivals. And that was sort of my first experience of having my work accepted internationally at these festivals and professionally and doing talks about it. So that was like extremely validating for me that it's not just the craft of animation, but it's actually me as a filmmaker that has something to offer as well.
For sure. And I mean, I'm just going to, my observation is that your interest in VFX and animation probably stood out because, you know, I mean, as someone who programs two film festivals and sees like 1500 submissions a year, like animation really stands out because it's not like it's easy to get a couple people together and shoot them in a living room having a conversation. But when you see animation, particularly digital animation, but I guess all animation is digital these days, pretty much. Every once in a while we get something hand-drawn and we're like, oh, that's so cool, or stop motion. But it's really, it's just really a delight, I think, to the human brain and to the eye that to see the creativity of digital animation. I mean, it's just, I mean, there's a reason why Pixar is what Pixar is, right?
You know, absolutely. It is a great like marriage of technical and artistic, and that is very much filmmaking, but I feel like it's almost to the nth degree with animation because there's so much technical requirements to get something so incredibly lifelike that you identify with it. So, I mean, there's just doing it, but also the patience and the time to keep working at it, to refine it, to improve it, to a point where it is completely integrated with the, whether it be a live action environment that you're working with, or be able to act and emote in a certain way that audiences can identify with it. Because these are inanimate objects that you're breathing life into. So it's such an interesting and enjoyable skill to have. It is pretty amazing.
It is. And it certainly resonates with something. So you had this wonderful experience as a very young person. Well, I consider 20s young, of going around to festivals and stuff. So you continue with that. And then I do know you end up in LA. So what led to the Vancouver to LA switch, or was it just you were outgrowing life in Vancouver? Because by the way, editors know Vancouver is like one of my favorite cities on earth. My best friend of 48 years lives in Vancouver now. So, I mean, but I understand being drawn to LA.
Yeah. I mean, I love Vancouver. It's like incredible. It's so beautiful there. You know, it's just, it's an amazing place to live and even visit. What happened was, so I was running my company, and then eventually the big stock market crash hit of 2008, and so advertising was drying up. There was no streamers at the time, like Netflix was probably still mailing DVDs to people. There was no like other broadcast, Hulu or anything like that. It was just traditional broadcast television that was our business and commercial work. So that stuff completely dried up, and we were kind of wondering what to do next. Did we just hold on or what? So at the time, I got an incredible offer by one of the biggest animation studios in Canada called Bardell Entertainment. They offered me the position to oversee two of their biggest franchise shows, which is Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the animated series, and Monsters vs. Aliens. So I thought, okay, well, this is a big step up for me. Now I can not only supervise 40 artists, but 100 plus. So I decided to go for it. And, you know, I really loved the owners of the business. I got along great with them. I got to meet their team. And it was an incredible experience, and I eventually helped grow that studio from around 100 employees to 500 at three different studio locations. And we got an absolute ton of work in. We did a feature film. We did many, many animated series work as well, with had lots of visual effects content in it. I was involved with building the pipeline, the workflow, doing hands-on look development tests for clients that landed the gigs, and then building workflows on how to achieve that look for a humongous team of artists. And eventually we started working with DreamWorks. And after several years, I was approached to come down to LA and work directly for DreamWorks on one of their biggest shows at the time, They were recently purchased by NBC Universal, and they had this big animated series that still was very effects intensive for the Fast and Furious franchise. And they told me they really wanted someone who had a really strong filmmaking aesthetic. It wasn't just someone who could help run an animation studio or do the technical and the artistic, but they wanted someone who was a filmmaker who really understood cinematography, camera, lenses. And they had expressed a lot of interest in my independent film work, which they caught wind of while I was at Bardell. And they thought I would be great on the show. So I had an absolute blast. I moved down to L.A., just loved working on the productions I was involved with there. And then eventually I wound up where I'm at now, which is Sony.
That's so cool that it's nice to hear that people who were decision makers were aware that you want the complete package, right? You want somebody not just who's great at the effects thing, but understands storytelling, understands camera, understands the filmmaking side. Because that is, that you can always tell, I think, as a viewer, as an audience member, if it's coming from a team that has a broader scope, or like, you know, you can always tell when it's like, well, you know, it looks great, but like they forgot to bother with a story or this or that.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow, amazing. Fantastic. And, you know, again, praise to you, man. It sounds like every step of the way, I just love that your skill set was acknowledged and your talent was appreciated. And it brought you all the way down here with this, and you ended up at Sony. Mm-hmm. Who, I didn't tell you this, my neighbor next door works at Sony for their video. Oh, no, he just left. I should shut up. So anyway. Is video game animation direction.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic. Yeah. I should meet him sometime.
I guess so. We'll walk over after this.
Oh, awesome.
No, I think he's probably... I think he moved over to Electronic Arts. But anyhow, this isn't about my neighbor. Just an odd coincidence.
Yeah,
good to know. He was always like, you're going to buy a Sony TV? I can get you a discount. So now I have to come to you for a discount.
Sure.
But cool. And... during that whole time that you went to, you know, over the company that did Ninja Turtles and then over to DreamWorks and then on to Sony, was there time for your own projects or were they sort of on hold for a while? Because it sounds pretty intensive.
Yeah, it was very intensive. I did have time to do my own projects. Evenings and weekends, I was able to pull off a couple of live action VFX heavy short films. And and now that I'm at Sony, I was able to do the same with my latest film, Pleroma. So still kept that going.
So, yeah, so such passion. And your personal life can handle it, I guess?
I kind of see it as like when I have a very, you know, wonderful personal life. It's not all filmmaking. I see it as, you know, when most people are... I don't know, watching TV or just chilling out or reading. That's kind of my time where I'm very focused on the filmmaking aspect. So I kind of fill up that sort of idle time with filmmaking because it's a hobby of mine. So it's not only a hobby, a career, an interest, a passion. So it is like, I'm not going to say it's effortless, but it just comes very natural to me. If I'm sort of sitting around, let's say playing a video game, I will get tired of that very quickly and be thinking, you know, I really want to start tinkering away at some of these CGI characters that I'm working on. So it's really that idle time that I fill with the filmmaking part.
Excellent. Excellent. I will might as well target it on Pleroma now. And did that start at DreamWorks or did it start at Sony? When did the idea first? Oh, no, you were up in Canada when it...
I came up with the idea and I wrote the script when I was in Canada, but I actually started working on the project sort of at my tail end of DreamWorks. So during the pandemic is when I was really a full tilt into production on that.
And the story, I assume it's, well, actually, you tell me, you know, right? Normally someone just sits down and writes a script, but you're a VFX, you're an artist as well. So do you start with some visuals? Do you start with story?
Yeah, that's a really good question. It's kind of a hodgepodge of everything. I think I probably did start with visuals. I knew I wanted to tell a film about AI and robotics and have a very, very grounded, real, like present day sci-fi element to it. So I wanted the robots to mimic what you see in those Boston Dynamic videos and what you see coming out of DARPA. So I knew that was the vibe that I wanted, and I knew that I wanted to be able to work on, have it be a thrilling, epic kind of feeling, but also work on some much deeper levels as well, as all good science fiction films and content do. So, I mean, that was my initial sort of vibe that I was going for, but the story just evolved out of that, really.
Right. So you visualize the robots in a way in different generations of robot sophistication,
mm-hmm.
and then you thought of a way for them to go at each other.
Yeah, exactly.
And they go at each other wonderfully. And now this is very funny because it occurred to me when I knew you were coming over this podcast, I'm like, you know what? I did not ask Chris at the Q&A at the theater where the title came from.
Ah,
I didn't ask you that.
Yes. Okay. So that's a good question. So Pleroma means to have the powers of a god. So
really, is it a Greek word?
I think so.
It's got
yeah.
A Greek vibe.
Yeah. Yeah. It's got a Greek vibe to
anything
it.
Anything paley, right?
Yeah. 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 So it is. It's so for the feature film script, the company is named Pleroma, but I thought it just fit well with the meaning of these creatures and what they're battling and stuff like that, and basically what this corporation is striving for.
Right. So that's about the AI then.
That's yeah, about that's about the sort they're, of they're, divine powers right, of AI.
Right. They've created a god that they yeah. can't control.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah.
It's pretty. Wow. I'm so glad I said it that way. That sounded really good.
You nailed it.
that is the story. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Basically, I mean, the idea is, and I've been doing research into AI and projecting how things could go into the future. So if I can go off on a little thought experiment here, which helps inform how I wanted to come up with this story. Right now with AI, it is very user driven. You tell the AI, I want to design me a frog in a canoe paddling down the river. It'll give you that. Or you say, write me a online article about, I don't know, cosmetics, and it'll do that. Where I see AI going is not specific at all. It would be like you ask the AI, I want to start a company in cosmetics directed at teenage girls. I want it to be an e-commerce business. Go. The AI will build the website. It'll design all of the artwork. It'll design the ad campaigns. It'll design social media posts, interaction with social media. It'll also interact with client orders and e-commerce. And the human just prompts the company and checks their bank account as the money comes in. And of course, what this will do to society is anyone's guess, but the advancement that is happening is going in that direction. So what I was thinking is, okay, well then in this scenario, where are the humans? What are they doing? Well, let's say this is a corporation. The board of directors are the ones who come up with the prompt. The COO, chief operating officer, or CEO, is the AI. And the humans are people who do what robotics can't currently do. So if you order a product, you still need someone to put it in the mail. You still need someone to drive over and deliver it. Sure, there are automated vehicles and stuff like that. But the robots aren't quite there that it'll like show up at your door with a package that it made. You know, maybe there's like a little bot that can deliver a pizza or whatever. But there's still like a lot of manual tasks that robotics cannot do. So the humans are doing that. So in this story, Pleroma, the humans are the low-level workers and the high-level executives is an AI, a super intelligence. So if you take this many steps further, let's say that the CEO, who's making the decisions of what the company does, is doing things that people don't even understand at this point. They build this little part here. Well, that fits over in this little part here, and this division does that. No one really understands what it's doing, but they don't care because the money's pouring in. And you've got these board of directors who are shareholders who, you know, just want the workers to fulfill the demands of the AI. So then you have a situation where they don't understand, but this AI is a superintelligence. So imagine Einstein, you know, 500,000 times even smarter. They worship it like a god. How could they know what to do? It's the AI that knows infinitely more than them, and it's not biased, it's not greedy, it's just fulfilling what the shareholders are asking it to do. So then with the story, eventually the AI is convincing the workers to piece together robotics that can replace the humans, and there's a whole, you know, everything sort of runs amok from there. And it sounds like a big downer, but the feature film script and even the short film touches on this, that you can always turn a negative into a positive, and that everyone has value. And this is a key component in the feature script. Even the homeless guy on the street who has a disability has value to add to this world, to this situation. And in fact, it's even those people that end up saving the day.
Right. So even though there's a doomsday element to the story, which we've had in other stories,
yeah,
I think it is fairly original. It's an original take to actually come around and say, but this is how it can all work with exactly. Humans included. Cause yeah, I mean, it's very funny. I always, whenever, I'm forgetting the name of the Terminator company, but whenever
Skynet,
yeah. Whenever people throw on Skynet, it's Skynet. I'm like, why would the AI care about killing all the humans?
Yeah.
Like it's just dramatic, but not actually logical, especially because they're, you know, even if like when you're talking about the general intelligence, mm-hmm. you know, yeah, once the AI can write its own algorithms and then you really are removing humans from the programming side and everything, which we're still needed for. Obviously, it's so funny. Everyone mm-hmm. talks about, boy, you were really timely with the whole AI thing.
Oh, I know.
Thing.
It's crazy. It's crazy how this.
But I mean, to not see ChatGPT and the image AI websites and stuff that's human coded. Like, mm-hmm. like it's really just tools that people made.
Exactly. Like to me, it's not like there's at no point in the feature or the short does it say the AI is conscious. They're just hyper intelligent algorithms that are fulfilling requests from humans. So let's say you have this massive corporation that humans are prompting it to do certain things. You know, there will be laws and rules in place about AI, but that doesn't necessarily mean everyone's going to follow them. So it's a scenario where you have a shady company who's willing to cut corners, who are prioritizing profits, and it's their vision that causes catastrophe. Not the robots are fulfilling an order, but they are doing it in a way that the humans don't understand. So they're being irresponsible about it. That sort of creates this disaster in the film. But it's not a Skynet thing where they just say, "Hey, we wake up, we're conscious, and now we want to be free." And
yeah, we want to go to war with our creators. Yeah,
no, it's more of a very sort of practical A to B kind of situation,
and it checks out. By the way, I'm going to back up because you mentioned an unhoused person being in your script and stuff. Mm-hmm. And in the short itself, in a way, the hero robot sort of arises almost as if he's the robot version of a homeless person.
Basically, yeah. He comes out of just wreckage, garbage. He was a discarded prototype from an amateur robotics engineer who was unsuccessful. This thing was scrapped and turfed in the garbage, but it was built with a core that was its intent was to help people, and it comes out of the rubbish and it attempts to do that.
Yeah, yeah. Its AI coding is protect humans.
Yes, yeah.
And what a fairly wonderful analogy to make of, I mean, because we discard humans. So this is a discarded robot. Mm-hmm. It's I think you kind of nailed something there.
Cool.
Very cool.
That was, yeah.
And I imagine it took you a while. I think we did talk about it a bit at the festival, but obviously from idea to screen, How long does the short is about 6 minutes, right?
Six to 10 minutes.
Six to 10. Okay.
Yeah, depending on which cut you watch. I have director's cut that's a little longer.
Oh, but. Nice. Well, I might hit you up for that one.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
I think I saw the 6.
Okay, yeah. So that is the trimmed down
version. You were like, hey, I'm submitting to festivals. I might as well be, right?
Festivals do tend to like shorter content.
They do, although as you notice at ours, it's like, yeah, you know, you've got a great 27-minute horror film. We're just going to show it.
Oh, yeah.
If it's great, it's great.
And they were great.
I know.
Every minute was worth it.
Believe me, sometimes I'm like, oh, man, why does this 32-minute thing have to be great? Because that's like a real challenge program. But anyhow, not about me. So from idea to completion, you want to talk about how much work you put into this and how many computers you had running at once?
Yeah, well, I made it entirely in my one-bedroom apartment at home at the time. I had 3 desktop computers pretty much running around the clock. So I would be animating or building some visual effects on one. Another would be caching a pyro simulation. And then the third computer would be rendering a sequence. So.
But you obviously, at some point, you had like a full script that you used as your guide, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I wrote a full script before going.
Wrote a full script, and then, because, right, like, well, now I'm thinking in terms of, I can't separate reality from fiction now, because I'm thinking about the world of Pleroma, and I'm thinking about, but you, the human, would come up with an idea, like, you can't just, like, your computers aren't, you can't just say, okay, give me an explosion, like, you're actually putting in a whole bunch of effort before you hit. Render? Would it be render?
Yes. Yeah.
So I'm just curious because I haven't been around VFX for a while. Mm-hmm. I actually used to be around VFX back in the practical days.
Oh, nice.
But I know, pretty weird back when everything had to be models and stuff. But does it take like a week of coding and planning and then you hit render or is it like a couple hours and then you hit render and it runs for 36 hours?
It's definitely not a couple hours and it all depends on the complexity of the shot. I mean, some shots had dozens of explosions going off while a robot was running through it, dodging the explosions. So there are different phases to it. To animate a sequence, sometimes that could take, depending, it could in 1 week, it can take you to animate, you know, about 10 to 18 seconds worth of footage. That's just animating. On top of that, you have to light it in a photoreal manner that integrates and matches the background footage that you shot. And so that takes time. And then the pyrotechnic simulations, the explosions, that's also feeding a whole bunch of different dynamics and algorithms that can compute this type of explosions to go off, but still extremely artistically driven. So, I mean, that doesn't factor all the trials and errors either. So there's a lot of time to take. And then once all of it's rendered, you have to composite it together and integrate it into the background footage. So
yeah,
it can take weeks for one shot, but I was working on multiple shots at one time. So when one was rendering, I'd be onto a different shot. And then when that was simulating, I'd jump onto another thing. So I was pretty much multitasking between the 3 computers at all times.
And then funny aside, I guess, did you have to have your AC running full blast? Because like 3 computers pumping out heat in a 1-bedroom apartment.
I was cranking the AC. I had multiple fans blasting at me. It was...
That's how good computers get hot when they're running this stuff.
Oh, completely. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's wild.
I nearly fried one. Actually, I did fry one of them.
Oh, one of them couldn't hold up. You gave
it just
more
died.
And more weight than it could carry.
Yeah, it was brutal.
Right. So you were actually, well, did you start with 3 or did you like start with 2? And then you're like, you know what? If I buy another computer, I can start cranking out more. Like you were rebuilding a shop.
Exactly. Yeah. Like I started with 2 computers that I had already had and they just weren't fast enough. Like I had them for a few years, but I needed something that was pretty much state of the art that could get me through this because I just didn't want the technology holding me back. It had to work for me for the production. So I needed things to work as fast as possible. So probably my biggest investment into the project was a state-of-the-art desktop computer.
Desktop, right. PC,
yep.
Windows.
Yeah.
And actually I should ask, what is there a couple software things I should add? Like, I don't know if it's After Effects or something else.
No. So basically for compositing, I use Nuke. It's pretty industry standard for like the high-end visual effects work. Houdini for the pyrotechnic simulations. Maya for animating and rigging the characters. I used a software called Substance Painter for hand painting, surfacing, and textures. And software called Meshroom, actually, that not a lot of people know about. Meshroom is a free software created by Autodesk. And what it is great for is not only does it track the motion of handheld or any camera footage into a virtual camera, but it also uses photogrammetry. So what that is it uses the images and parallax to calculate three-dimensional terrain that your footage has been shot on. So by doing this simultaneously, you have a virtual camera and you have geometry from the environment that you can now place the character into, and you can integrate it in that environment in the sort of virtual sense, yet it all sort of works and integrates together. And another level of that is it also maps the footage onto this geometry, so you get the texture on that geometry as well. So that geometry can now add bounce lighting that helps integrate the CGI characters even more realistic.
I mean, I throw around the term world building a lot when talking to people who just in their mind create a world on the page. Mm-hmm. But I mean, this is pure world building on the virtual level.
100%. It's like we're talking virtual sets. So you are building a three-dimensional world, so to speak, or set or environment that you can put a virtual camera in and frame it however you want. Now, if you're matching it to a backplate, obviously you have to frame it exactly as the footage was shot. But what I had done, because I didn't have access to all the environments that I shot in all the time, so I actually did rebuild them virtually. So they rendered themselves as photorealistic backgrounds that I can then restage the camera, put the CGI characters there, and create entirely new shots and sequences just at my computer.
Yeah, but actually, like you didn't mention the lab up in Canada where you got to shoot.
Oh, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I had shot the most, if not all, the interiors at a particle nuclear physics laboratory. So it's the Particle Nuclear Physics Laboratory of Canada. It's called Triumph. And the interior of this laboratory is massive. And it is filled with particle accelerators and the most unbelievable technological machinery that I've ever seen. And you've got, it looks like someone's came in and built the most amazing sci-fi set ever, but it's all real. And there are scientists and lab coats working there, and there's dry ice. Like, it looks like someone put a fog machine in there, but it's actually real. And I mean, you just point a camera around there and you feel like you're in a sci-fi film set.
And did you already have Pleroma in your mind and working, and then you saw that set? Or set, I called it a set. You saw that lab? Or because you were at that lab working, doing work for them?
Yeah. So going way back when I ran my own animation and visual effects studio, this company, Triumph, had hired us. So they were a client for us to depict their particle simulations in CGI so they can sort of critique the work that they're doing, so they can showcase the work that they're doing. Because obviously it's very hard to understand or even visualize, but we were hired to depict that type of work in CGI. So I built a relationship with them. They were really happy with the work that we did. And I knew that just they allowed us to tour the plant, and it was such an incredible place. I knew I had to film something there. And like, flash forward a decade later, if not more, and I'm like, oh my God, I have to go back. And for this robot film, this has to be my backdrop. So,
okay, so you had that lab in the back of your mind for a decade, and then you're like, okay, now's my time to call them up and say, hey, remember me?
Yeah, exactly.
And they did.
Their first response was, categorically no. Like, we never let anyone film here because, as you can imagine, everyone would want to film something there. And they say no because the proprietary nature of their equipment, how disruptive it would be for their scientists, and for many other reasons, for danger and liability factors. But I talked to them. I'm like, look, I'm kind of a one-man crew here. I have a couple actors. I come in with a camera. I can do a quick shoot. And they said, well, you know what? We really enjoyed working with you. So we'll do you a favor. We'll give you one day to come in, shoot everything you can, and then and you can use that for your film. So I was obviously thrilled, but a little stressed out to cram so much of that into a day. But I was able to do a hell of a lot in there. And then anything that I wasn't able to accomplish, I built as a virtual set replica of that environment that I
right.
Can
so you were able to take that real environment that you shot in with like a Red or something, I imagine, or
just a Canon DSLR.
DSLR. No, yeah, exactly. Because yeah, who cares about the 10-minute limit or whatever, right? Yeah,
right.
Right. So, but a quality DSLR, and but then once you had that, you could recreate it digitally and do anything you wanted. Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah.
And then I always meant to ask, like, and then the exteriors, was that here at the Sepulveda Dam?
Yes. Yeah, it was. Yeah. And so it's a funny story.
It's funny. When I first saw it as I'm a native Valley boy, I've spent almost 55 years in the San Fernando Valley, except for about 15 I was away. So actually, yeah, your film looks like a local film to me. Because you use like... the landmark visual thing, like, that Hollywood just keeps going back to.
I know. Okay, so like I said, I was from Canada. I am from Canada. I've lived out here for 4.5, almost 5 years now. Now, keep in mind, 2 of those years was during the pandemic. So I didn't see a lot of L.A. So during the pandemic, you know, I went on a hike and I just stumbled across the most awesome looking location, the Sepulveda Dam, because it too looks like a sci-fi environment, but an exterior. And I thought, oh my God, this is incredible. I just have to use this for the film. Plus, it's very open, so there's a lot of space for, you know, robots to come in and fight each other and stuff like that. So I was thrilled. So I started shooting there, and then I posted a little thing online, check out how awesome this location is. I'm making my movie here. And then everyone replied saying, do you realize how many movies have been shot there? That is like the most iconic location. And then I felt like, oh no, because the last thing I wanted, or any filmmaker wants, is to be pulled out of a story and say, oh yeah, that was used in this other movie, or I recognize that. So it's kind of like, I was a little bummed out about it, especially because I thought I found this, you know, special sort of treasure of place to film. But yeah, anyways, still love the spot.
Did you just sneak over there with your DSLR?
But run and gun.
Yeah. Which you can. I mean, and by the way, for those who don't know it, it's funny to assume everyone in the world knows about the Sepulveda Dam. But it also has a post-apocalyptic feel, right? Mm-hmm. Because we say the words dam, it's for the LA River, which is like a trickle. and it's really because the San Fernando Valley flooded like crazy, I think, in the 50s. And so the Army Corps of Engineers came in and took our natural river and put it into concrete channel, and then it comes there. So when there is a big rain, homes don't get destroyed. But it's basically just like an empty cement basin full of weeds.
Yeah.
Almost all year.
Yeah. And it just looks cool. It's concrete. It has a strange, interesting structure to it. You don't, at least for me, I don't look at it and think, damn. I just think this weird kind of just concrete, interesting looking structure. So I thought
it really is. Yeah. So there you go. Your visual eye paid off, and no worries about whatever. I feel bad that people made you feel bad that you, you know, look at this amazing place. And I was like, they use it in Key and Peele, but
yeah, exactly.
But, yeah, it's the best place in the world to have gangsters shoot at each other. Cause there's nowhere to run.
Yeah. There you go.
It's got to keep shooting. But, so that's cool. So that all came together. And so then so it's amazing, right? So I'm picturing you as the one person band, like you were obviously like with your DSLR, you were also recreating action sequences there. So are you just like running? Or are you on rollerblades? Like how are you, right? Cause your camera's moving pretty fast
yes,
to keep up with your actors who are virtual.
Yes. Yeah. So what I did, I had the Ronin M camera gimbal. So it's a camera stabilizer. So you can pretty much get a lot of really nice, smooth movements with it. So yeah, I would be running all over the place with the thing. I also used what's called a DJI Osmo Pocket Cam. So it's this little camera that can fit in your pocket, and it actually has a handle and a gimbal mount built into it. So what you can do with it is it's very small and light. So you can attach it to the end of a monopod, so a long pole, and then you can remote it to your cell phone. So your cell phone is not only a viewfinder for this camera, so you can see what you're filming, but you can also pan and tilt the gimbal with it from your phone. So if you hold this pole really high up in the air, you get this crazy sort of bird's eye view, and then you can see and control the framing. And then also you could hold it really low to the ground and just run with the thing. So, I mean, these robots came in all sizes. Some of them flew, some of them crawled on the ground, some of them were bipedal human-like. And I was just able to achieve a humongous range of camera angles from just these few pieces of equipment.
That's so cool. We joked about how this is an audio-only podcast. People would have really enjoyed, if this were on YouTube, watching your hand describe this stuff. But that it sounds like you're able to be... It's the ground equivalent of a drone pilot, right? Because those drone pilots are controlling not just where the drone flies, but the camera panning, tilting, yep, zooming in, zooming out. So was that a skill you had to practice a couple times?
I did, yeah, definitely. And I also do fly drones, so I did have a drone as well. But those are for like the very high up aerial shots. And what I was able to do, which was super cool, is that photogrammetry technique that I described of literally rebuilding the environment virtually is, from the perspective of a drone, you can really map out a humongous portion of your set. So having a aerial shot of a robot running in this environment, I was able to animate this camera swooping in down to ground level from aerial to achieve that shot virtually. And it was all based on photogrammetry that I built from the drone footage. So, yeah.
So this is a pithy comment, but I can't help it. If you ever do it again, you got it. I know it. You're doing this all by yourself. You got to have a friend come and shoot you doing it, because that would have been the coolest behind the scenes stuff ever, watching someone just run around by himself with this cool equipment in this
totally.
Basin. Like, that would be so cool.
It would also look a little ridiculous, because 90% of the time there was no actors in the frame.
Yeah, so exactly.
It
looks like I'm running filming around nothing. But that would be, to see that and then see the completed shot, mm-hmm, would be so cool. I can't help but want to see, because you know, I have a couple friends who are VFX artists and stuff, and you know, you'll see like when they do a logo, like you know, I guess I shouldn't name, but like we'll do like a logo for like a country's, you know, anniversary, and like you'll see the different generations of all the layers that went into it. Mm-hmm. Would have been so cool to like see you do that, and then see your footage, and then see your footage with the basic, and then see your footage with the completed. Like, it would just be, I mean, I think it's endlessly fascinating.
I do have a VFX breakdown that does have that kind of thing. You don't see me filming, but you see the plate before the effects was added and then the different layers to it. So like I was mentioning, a shot with the robot and explosions going off, or multiple robots, there's a lot of layers involved to achieve that. So that's something, a link I could share later.
Yeah, yeah. No, I just wish you had the footage of the person who looks like they're having a nervous breakdown running away from invisible robots.
Yeah, totally.
But also flying a drone. I mean, it's all cool.
Yeah.
And yeah, man. And no, if you, I mean, you just have so many different skills and so many different interests in, or such a complete involvement in every level of this. I'm sure people would hit you up all the time for, but you have a great job. So you don't, you got time for your job, and you got time for your, I'll just call it your art, mm-hmm, on your own. And I imagine friends come up to you and go, hey, will you, you're like, no, I'm, what do you think? You're going to invent a 36 hour day?
Yeah, no kidding.
But people would be, yeah, desperate to work with you. Wow. I see big things for you. No, you're already there.
No, no, there's a long way to go still, but thank you.
Yeah, yeah. Well, is it the kind of thing where the Pleroma feature would be like taking a 6-month sabbatical or something? Like, you can't do that in your spare time, can
yeah,
you?
No, of course not. Yeah, I would have to work all of that out. I mean, but that is the goal. So that would be something that I would have to plan for. So we'll see.
Yeah, well, I'm rooting for you.
Appreciate it.
And since completing it, well, so when did you finish it? When did, like, does it take the discipline? Like, obviously, like, screenwriters, at some point you have to say, all right, I'm going to stop rewriting this. And like, is it hard for you as a VFX artist to say, all right, I'm not going to add any more little touches?
Oh, that was really hard, especially when you have no specific deadline. So,
yeah,
and then I'm doing it every myself.
Client.
I'm doing everything myself, so I don't feel the burden of asking people for more. So, yeah, I mean, there was a point where I realized, like, every time I finish a shot, I come up with two more shots I want to add. So it was just felt like it was never ending. But finally, I got to a point where I was actually, like, really satisfied. It wasn't like I felt like I cut it off. I just was like, okay, this actually feels like really good to me now. What I was envisioning, this is definitely hitting that. And then the fine tuning on top of that was probably more or less getting, and any artist should do this, and most do, I know. But the fine tuning came a lot from screening it in front of industry people that I've either worked with or I know personally. There was a VFX supervisor whose opinion I really trust. And he always has good feedback. The feedback, even though sometimes I hate hearing it because it adds so much work, it always makes the quality that much better. So I would go to this person for the feedback. And then I had I have a really good friend who's an editor, and he would give me feedback on the editing. But sometimes he'd have actually really good insight on the how the VFX looked from a non-VFX person. He'll just say, this doesn't feel right, or this doesn't look. And he just has an incredible eye for stuff. So I just really enjoyed, you know, bouncing ideas off them, getting that work in front of them. Also, I have a producer / actress star of the film who you met, Jeff. Kiana Alitaha is her name, and she was always at any given hour of the night ready to offer thoughts and opinions and feedback on the work, and she was always available to shoot. So if I needed to shoot something super early in the morning or late in the wee hours of the night, she was always up for it and very happy to do so. So it was just an incredible person to collaborate with, and just having great industry contacts to get feedback from.
Yeah, yeah, and you utilized her on camera and behind the camera.
Exactly,
But she's the sole human who appears in the film.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And because she's wearing a wig in the film.
Yeah.
I didn't recognize her when you brought her to the mixer. You're like, she's in the film. I'm like, oh, natural hair. I get it.
The funny thing was, is she was in the previous, I made a previous film about alien abductions. So she was in that film as well. So I wanted her to look different, so people weren't like, oh, you just work with the same actress all the time. But I'm willing to work with other actresses. But I just thought, I think the wig just suited the environment and the style. I thought it was just a good look.
Hey, I'm going to just say she's your Sigourney. Like,
exactly. Right?
Like no one looks at James Cameron and goes, you going to use Sigourney Weaver again? Like, of course he's going to use Sigourney Weaver. Why would you freaking use Sigourney Weaver if you got her, or if you could just text her and say, hey, I got another one for you.
Yeah, 100%.
Super, super. And I assume she was there with you and supported you the whole way. So she's obviously really proud of it too.
Oh yeah, she's thrilled about the whole thing.
Yeah, yeah, very cool. I know, she's in this amazing film where she's the sole human.
Exactly.
And you're not going to recast her in the feature, I assume, so.
Oh, I definitely have her in the feature.
Excellent.
100%, yep.
Excellent, somewhere.
Somewhere, definitely.
You're not going to compromise on that.
Yeah.
Even if someone goes, here's a $250 million budget, but I'm not going to play that game.
if someone says Scarlett Johansson is perfect for this particular role, sure, I'll consider it. But there'll be another role for Keanu for
there
sure.
There will be.
And a significant one at that.
There will be. That's right. That's right. And she'll hold her own with Scarlett. I'm sure.
Absolutely.
I'm sure. Cool. Well, now that it's, well, it's on the circuit and you're doing your L.A. premiere, your which is, yeah, your hometown of four and a half years. So it's, I don't know, probably doesn't feel like home yet.
It's getting there.
How many years were you in Vancouver?
Oh, probably about 20, I would say.
20? Okay,
yeah,
so.
Yeah.
So, like.
I was most
the biggest
of my,
chunk of your life.
The
was
biggest
there.
Chunk of my life was Vancouver,
right,
for sure.
Right. First 18 plus in Ontario,
yeah.
I guess.
Well, first five technically in Montreal, Canada.
Oh,
but,
Montreal.
Yeah.
Well, you have a very non-French name.
That's true.
But there are. Yeah, whatever. I've you'll get a kick out of this as a Quebecois or whatever. I have friends who are married. They met here. They're both from Quebec, and she was English Jewish Quebec, and he was French Catholic Quebec. They met here, fell in love, and got married because they both missed Montreal.
Huh.
But they both said, "Oh no, if we'd met in Montreal, I would have been like, I'm not gonna date that English-speaking girl," and she was like, I wasn't going to hang out with a French guy, but then here they fell in love.
That is hilarious.
It is hilarious. If we'd stayed in Montreal, we would have avoided each other. Here, we bonded over being from Montreal.
Oh, wow. Fantastic.
All right, so 5 years in Montreal, then small town outside of Toronto.
Yep.
Then Vancouver for, wow, 2 decades.
Yeah.
So you must really love it.
I did love it, yeah.
Yeah.
And the industry is great there. It's thriving. For visual effects work and animation, it is a bit of a hub for that.
For sure. No, and you were there during the glory days.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, I guess the glory days haven't really ended, but yeah, I mean, well, I'm old enough to remember when it was a big deal that the X-Files and things were shot up there. And
all
of a sudden, American TV started abandoning... Not a lot of it, but well, a lot of it went up mm-hmm. to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I always joke with my friend, you know, thanks to climate change, we'll have L.A. weather in Vancouver soon. And,
yeah.
And then I can move there for good because he won't let me visit during winter.
You know, it's funny when I moved down here and talking to other people in the industry, it's like, there's so much work up in Canada. Why would you come down here? But to be honest, well, one, I did have some great opportunities, but I also wanted to be where the source is. You know, where people envision these projects, they work with executives who take on these higher budget productions. And this is kind of where I really wanted to sort of grow.
Well, and in spite of all the production in Vancouver, mm-hmm. like you said, the decisions are here. It's still an LA based studio.
Yeah.
You can't, you know, you couldn't have, DreamWorks doesn't have the positions there that they do here.
Certainly not at the like the executive level and that kind of thing. So
it
was definitely an opportunity worth coming down
yeah.
for.
No, and you know, wow, this is an egotistical thing for a native Angeleno to say, but now you're at the summit. Like there's no city to move to after LA.
Yeah.
Like
this is it.
As long as things stay the way they are. And mm-hmm. I don't see the studios putting in the money to move all their headquarters somewhere else.
Not the core. Definitely
not the core.
I mean, there's so much. I'm just speculating, but there's so much infrastructure here. There's such a community here. That would be strange.
Yeah, it'd be ridiculous. Yeah, there's satellites in Atlanta, here, there, and everywhere. But this is still
the hub.
Rightfully, the hub of the industry. It all started in, I guess, the 1920s or something. It was when they were like, "Hey, let's just move out to California where you can shoot year round. No mm-hmm. reason to stay in New York."
Mm-hmm.
All right, cool. Well, anything else you want to add? Anything I left out? Or
no, I just have to thank you. I had such an incredible time at Film Invasion LA. It's one of the most enjoyable experiences I've had at a film festival. I think you were an incredible film festival host, program director, all of the above. It was such a... And meeting the other great cast of... filmmakers to meet there, and the quality of their productions were extremely entertaining. So yeah, I'm just happy to be involved. So thank you very much.
Yeah. And you got to, and you did what I love to see at a festival, which is you showed up, you came, you watched other things, you, and you did that wonderful thing. Right. I mean, I think most filmmakers are, well, not everyone's good about watching other people's blocks and features and things, but it's so great to support another filmmaker and then walk up to them afterwards and say, hey, I really like that. Mm-hmm. Like some people are a little aloof about it, I think. And I think it's, if you want to get the most out of a festival, you just have to walk up and tell people how good what they did was.
Yeah, supporting the other filmmakers is great, but there's also a very tangible benefit you get out of it from attending, because you see this cutting edge work that you would never see otherwise, and it's very original. It's stuff that is not typically produced, but it is stuff that should and will be picked up eventually. You meet filmmakers who are doing incredible work that are going other places in the industry, and you build this, your community, your networking, and you learn from their experiences as filmmakers. Talking to some of the filmmakers at Film Invasion LA, I learned that building or creating an awesome 20-minute movie in 3 days is possible with a great location and a few actors around, and they did a great job of it. So you just learn so many things and you build your network. So many people say that I've heard who want to get in the industry, oh, it's all about who you know. And there is a truth to that, but it's also how much work are you willing to put in to get to know those people? So it can be about who you know. Of course, there's talent and hard work and all that involved. But to get to know those people, you have to put in the work. When I'm growing up in Ontario, way north of Toronto, I didn't know anyone in the film industry, but it's just constantly putting in the work, being very interested and attending film festivals and meeting people in the industry and picking their brains and putting the effort to get out and go is critical. So, and it's super fun. It's like some of the most enjoyable experiences you can have as a creative. So
it is, and it's great for you as a creative, and it's great for film lovers. It's just great for. I admit it has really been. I've almost got like a decade of two festivals a year now, and it almost ruins my experience watching, you know. Not to insult Hollywood stuff, but like the personal connection that filmmakers have to their work at the festival level and how much more passion's involved. I think, you know, I think it makes it, I'm kind of addicted to it. Like I just really appreciate that kind of production, that kind of art versus, you know, not that there isn't very commercial stuff at the festival level, but you know, it's still coming from the right place, I feel. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a big difference between the film that a filmmaker has in their heart and mind that they just have to get on screen. And, you know, the thing where it's like, well, you know, buddy cop comedies are selling pretty well. Let's, you know, whip one of those out and put these two actors in it. And okay, now we don't have an idea, but we know what movie we're making. Like, mm-hmm. You know, it just bothers me.
No, absolutely. And there's so much out there that is remakes, spinoffs, sequels, that, you know, to see fresh content that is very original and well-made, well-produced, super interesting that you've never seen before, you get so much out of it. And I think, you know, as audiences get fatigued with seeing the same type of productions, Hollywood's going to start looking for stuff that is more original. And these are the filmmakers that are coming up and creating this stuff and proving that they can not only do it on their own, but they'll probably do a pretty good job on it. So I think that things will start to take a shift in that direction.
Agreed. And with the new world of tech we live in that is, I mean, you and I are talking right now during a WGA/SAG/AFTRA strike over the really how technology is changing the way entertainment is distributed. Hopefully there are going to be ways for this quality stuff to get out to audiences, mm-hmm. which is setting up my closer here. But do you want to mention websites or social media that people should follow if they want to stay up with you and your work?
Yeah, definitely. My website is chrisbrowndigital.com. So that's Chris Brown with an E at the end of Brown, digital.com. You can check that out. You can see samples of my work. You can see trailers. Some of the film festivals will be listed that it's screening at. You'll also get informed on when it will be released online. And you can check out some behind the scenes making of. There's a lot of visual effects and robots and all kinds of crazy stuff. So you can see what went into making that. And then from there, you can reach out to me. There's links for LinkedIn. That's sort of my favorite of the social medias. But of course, I'm on Facebook too. But reach out to me on LinkedIn. I love to hear stories of what other filmmakers are up to and to share ideas. So I would say that would probably be the place to go.
Excellent. I am so clueless on LinkedIn. I even asked my niece who's starting her senior year of college this week, and she's a business major, and she's like, "Hey, I had one of my classes, like my job was to do my LinkedIn page." And I'm like, "Oh, will you do mine? Because I think mine is an embarrassment." But anyhow, not about me. All right, so you just heard how to follow Chris, which means I am about to do my closing spiel, where I name all the social media and website stuff for the things that led to this podcast. But first, yeah, you're listening to the Discover Indie Film podcast. If you need to learn more or want to learn more, you go to discoverindiefilm.com. And on all the social media platforms, it's at DIFWINS. And, you know, this podcast did give birth to a TV series that's on Amazon Prime. So if you go to Amazon Prime Video on, hopefully on a big TV, don't watch movies on your phone. I mean, I say that a lot, but go to your Prime Video app on a big TV and type in Discover Indie Film. I believe it auto-completes once you get past Discover India. And enjoy, right now there's 7 seasons. It's all, it's just a TV series. It's short films handpicked from the festival circuit. So knock on wood, someday maybe Pleroma will be on there. I don't know, no pressure. And I think I've said, and like and subscribe. And, you know, if you want to be a really nice person, even write, you know, watch the TV series and write a nice review on Amazon about it. Because, you know, why not? Anyway, and Chris was kind enough to say things about Film Invasion Los Angeles. We hold that festival every June. And I am the festival runner, I guess. Used to call myself head programmer, but friends started calling me the festival runner. I'm like, I guess that's the right term. I don't know. It is what it is. So anyway, you can learn about Film Invasion LA if you go to filminvasionla.com, and it's at Film Invasion LA on social media. And its sister festival that we hold in November is the Sherman Oaks Film Festival, and you can learn about that one at shermanoaksff.com, and it's at shermanoaksff on social media. And the last thing to mention is, yeah, I don't know, because I love indie film, because I love the people who make them, I can't stop myself, so... I was approached by a company that does smart TV apps, OTT, they kept hitting me up to do one for Discover Indie Film. I'm like, come on, man, it's a podcast. It's a TV series on Amazon Prime. Like, I'm not going to start a streaming service. And then I got the idea, because I see so many films. So last year, or actually earlier this year, on 420, we launched TV High, which you can learn about if you go to watchtvhigh.com, and it's at watchtvhigh on social media. On social media, it's watchtvhi. But actually, if you go to watchtvhi or watchtvhigh.com, both of those work online. And it's a new streaming service that's filled with great indie content. And it does have this little angle that it's called TV High because a lot of it's meant to be watched if you're stoned. If you enjoy marijuana responsibly, I have friends in recovery, so I always mention you should be responsible. But by the way, like, all the films are great sober too. But anyway, so people can learn about that if they go to watchtvhigh.com. In fact, if you use the code STREAM420, you get a free month trial instead of a free week trial. So, hey, I should come up with a unique one for the podcast so I know if anyone ever signs up from hearing this. But anyway... All right, that's the 4 things I'm supposed to mention. I don't think I'm supposed to mention anything else. Although I'm going to say right now while we're recording, make me take your picture as soon as we finish this. Because at the very top of my page in notes, it says take pic in a font that's 5 times larger than the rest. And I didn't take a pic. So I'm going to have to take your picture with me. And Chris Brown, thanks so much.
Thank you, Jeff. Pleasure to be here.
And when this one finishes, we're going to record your four questions. And yeah, excellent. Thank you, everyone, for listening.